Craig Craig's going to talk to us for about half hour, 40 minutes, thereabouts. I'll start dinging if he goes over time. And then we'll have some questions, answers, usual drill. So away you go. Thanks, Craig.
Thank you. Today I'd like to talk to you about Solvency II. And in particular, what I'm really concerned about here is the impact that Solvency II might have on the Australian insurance industry, or Australian actuaries, or you guys, essentially. Now, just before we start, I'd like a quick show of hands from you. First up, who here thinks that they will be directly impacted by Solvency II? Quite a few of you. And who here thinks they'll be maybe indirectly impacted by Solvency II? Yeah, so again, quite a few more. And who here thinks that they're here to hear about the Retirement Income Party Task Force? Good, no one. That's always good. Well, you know, I would say from an outside point of view that that's perhaps a little bit surprising, given that Solvency II is something that's been developed on the other side of the globe for an insurance industry which looks and feels quite different, I guess, to the Australian insurance industry. Obviously, you can probably tell from my accent that my background is in the UK and in Europe, in advising insurance companies on risk and capital management issues. So I think one of the key things that we'll draw out of today is that essentially Solvency II actually borrows very heavily from the Australian solvency regime. And from that point of view, you're going to see an awful lot of similarities and applications, which I think will be worthy of a bit of further note. So quick agenda. First up, I'll give you a bit of background on Solvency II. So largely just discussing what's actually in Solvency II from a capital point of view. Then a few thoughts on some of the implications that Solvency II might actually have when it comes to asset liability management of insurers and some of the issues and challenges, I guess, that are going to arise on the back of it. I do have a couple of little case study examples. We may or may not get to those, and I may completely gloss over those and refer you back to the paper, which is up on the website, depending on how time goes. And then last, and I hope this is really what triggers a bit of discussion today, what it actually means for Australian actuaries as far as Solvency II goes. First up, a little bit of background on Solvency II. Essentially, the introduction of Solvency II will be the first time that a comprehensive risk-based capital regime has existed across all of Europe. Now, what that means is standardised rules across 27 different countries. So that involves all of the EU countries, plus it actually involves regulatory input and regulatory regimes in the likes of Switzerland, Norway, Liechtenstein, and Iceland, most of which are on the fringes of Europe or affiliated with Europe but not actually part of the EU. Probably worth pointing out that there's absolutely no accounting treatment within Solvency II. It's purely a capital framework here. But the assumption that's been made and the way the Solvency II framework has been developed has largely been around making sure that Solvency II is massively consistent, or as consistent as can be at the moment, with IFRS Phase 2 when it actually arrives. It's probably worth mentioning the linkage here between the aims of Solvency II and the principles behind Solvency II and the large push in, I guess, the global insurance industry to ERM movements. Ultimately, the aim of Solvency II is to fully integrate risk management and capital adequacy framework of insurers so that essentially those are an integral part of an insurance business. Now, the regulations, as they look at the moment and probably ultimately will, aim to do that in a number of ways. So specifically, they encourage the use of internal models from insurers, which essentially will be or should be integrated into the business, and we'll touch on that and how it actually manifests itself and what it actually means shortly. It's a three-pillar approach, which should look pretty familiar to anyone who has gone through any sort of BAL2 process. So the first pillar, which is looking pretty comprehensive and covers most things, is the quantitative pillar. Now, that pillar essentially involves both a set of specified rules and a number of judgment and company-specific parameters on which to base capital calculations for a firm. The second phase, and this is probably the one which is most in its infancy at the moment, is the set of qualitative supervisory review rules for insurers. Now, given the vast majority of risks that insurance schemes or insurance companies will run into or will actually have on their books are going to be covered under Pillar 1, it does remain to be seen what will actually fall into the remit of the supervisory review process. And that's something which has largely been relatively quiet to date from the European regulators. The third pillar is a market discipline pillar, or mainly a disclosure and transparency set of rules. I guess the interesting thing from that point of view is that the second pillar, the supervisory review process, is actually going to be very open. So unlike, I think, most supervisory regimes where capital tends to be a relatively private thing between regulator and insured company, or insurance company, essentially that whole process will be open to a large amount of public scrutiny. And I guess that will mean that rating agencies and various other interested parties will be looking over these things with a great amount of interest and a great amount of detail. As far as the approach, it's an aggregate economic balance sheet approach, which most people will be familiar with here. We'll touch a bit more on what that actually means in a second. One of the key things which insurance groups connected with Solvency II have spent an awful lot of time looking at and certainly lobbying about is essentially the amount of diversification they can gain credit for across their entire group. That sort of group focus has been a large element of the focus, if you like, and those representations have been particularly strong. We'll come on to some of the ALM impacts later, but essentially some of the internal modelling techniques that have been developed already across the globe to deal with some of these issues have been developed and calibrated very much with gaining credit for some of those diversification benefits in mind. In terms of timescales, these things are always a moving feast. At the moment, there is a draft framework which has been published, updated as of this April. There have been three quantitative studies already to try and essentially calibrate the Solvency II framework. The fourth of those studies, which is looking more or less like the final study, is actually underway at the moment, results due later on this year. Implement measures by the end of 2010, and the regime is aimed to be in place by 2012. Those look like relatively long timescales, I guess. For anyone that's been through these sorts of change processes with the likes of BAL2, they're painful, and they do take an awful long time to happen. I guess Solvency II has probably been in the pipeline for in the region of 20 years now. So these things are never exactly fast-paced. Why Solvency II? Well, for the simple reason that the current European set of frameworks just isn't very risk-based. The Solvency I regime, which was introduced really as a stopgap measure a few years ago, is a factor-based kind of old-style regime aimed at trying to hold capital against risks very much in isolation. And it does give rise to some fairly anomalous products and capital rules which just don't necessarily align to the genuine economic risks that an insurance company actually has on its books. There's one example of this that I always remember coming across where there's a fairly large insurance group based in continental Europe, in Germany. And under their existing rules, they had developed a number of rather wacky-looking products that once they actually implemented the sort of internal modelling which is essentially envisaged under Solvency II, they actually realised that the potential for them to run into some serious problems through some rather nasty interest rate interactions was such that it essentially swamped all other interests within their group. This is from a relatively small life insurance part of the group. Now, it's that sort of element which the existing rules just don't simply align to. So it's pretty obvious that Solvency II is needed in Europe. And a number of regulators at the moment have gone down the route in Europe of essentially implementing various measures which lead up to Solvency II. So you've got the likes of the UK, Switzerland, where there are relatively advanced risk-based capital regimes. I think it's safe to say that Solvency II principles have been drawn very heavily from the current Australian capital regime. And I would certainly expect to see any changes in the way Solvency II moves from here being relatively well aligned to Australian rules. Something which Greg actually mentioned earlier this morning in his introductory speech, which I think is quite pertinent, which is that I think largely Australia has been at the forefront of methodology in a number of aspects of actuarial science, if you like, or actuarial field. And I think this is just another example of that in action. So we'll come back to that as we go later. Quick overview of what Solvency II actually looks like. I mentioned that the aim here is for an overall group economic balance sheet type approach. And essentially, the picture I have here is based on the latest quantitative impact study picture of Solvency II as it currently stands, so the latest draft position under QIS 4. And as I said, most of those risks are addressed within Pillar 2, 1 that an insurer will actually have on its books. Essentially, the way Solvency II is lined up is that there's a market consistent definition of assets and of liabilities. Now, for assets, that's obvious. For liabilities, we measure them on an exit value basis. Now, that's quite a different conceptual approach from the solvency regime in Australia at the moment, where essentially the intention here is to make this consistent with IFRS. So essentially, you have a fair value, whatever that means, of liabilities that you have to hold capital to meet, given your current asset holdings. That's broken down into two elements. You have hedgeable risks and non-hedgeable risks under Solvency II. Hedgeable risks are essentially market risks. And the liability value that you put on that is just simply the hedge value or the market value for that particular liability. I think it's safe to say that for an insurance company, the expectation is that the vast majority of risks will not fall into that category. Most of them will be, in some sense, non-hedgeable. So, obviously, any sort of insurance risk is by and large, going to be a non-hedgeable risk. And the valuation approach there is simply to say that the liability value is best estimate plus a risk margin. Now, in this case, it's probably worth pointing out that best estimate is a best estimate of all liabilities. It's not just contractual liabilities, and it includes, for instance, any credit for future charges that may be greater than future benefits, for instance. So on something like a unit-linked contract, you may well expect to see that best estimate liability actually being less than a unit value. There's no cap in terms of a unit value or the likes, or a CTV, which you might see at the moment in Australia. The risk margin is based on a cost of capital methodology, and I'm not really going to go into this in a great deal of detail here, but the basic concept is you calculate some capital charges across the entire life of a book of business based on some of the non-hedgeable risks. You essentially take a cost of capital for each of those charges and you PV them back to the present time, and that is your risk margin. That cost of capital is intended to be, if you like, a perfect cost of capital across the entire market, so a frictional cost of capital that a firm willing to buy out those liabilities might actually incur. And as such, it's likely to be determined by the regulators rather than a company-specific number. There's two levels of capital requirements that you calculate based on those liabilities. You've got an MCR, or minimum capital requirement, which is the point of ultimate regulatory intervention, much like a solvency capital requirement here. The aim of that one is to be very simple, easy to calculate. The latest guidance makes something of a mockery of that, if I want to express a personal opinion, by simply calling it a proportion of the SCR, which is the solvency capital requirement, or essentially the point of closer regulatory intervention when it comes to looking at capital requirements. The SCR is calculated based on a one-year VAR approach, based on stressing those assets and liabilities. Now, that can be calculated in one of two ways, either by some standard formulae, we'll touch on that in a second, or via an internal model. And again, we'll touch on that one as well. So again, you can see the similarities with the Australian rules are pretty large here. In terms of those standard formulae, the way solvency standard formula work, essentially that you calculate an individual risk charge on each policy, policy by policy basis, across a number of individual risk charge levels. And those are characterised or broken down into essentially as many different types of risk as you can come up with largely for an insurance company that you can quantify. So that's broken down within life risks, general insurance risks, health risks, market risks, and so on. And within each of these, you'll have a capital charge for each individual risk. All should look nice and familiar. Within those, they're all combined via just a simple linear correlation approach. So individual risks are just correlated through a simple correlation matrix to combine up to the higher level here. So, for instance, all life risks will be correlated across that simple matrix. And then at that aggregate level, again, you'll just correlate all risks using another simple linear correlation matrix. It's probably worth commenting on this stage that in practice this probably doesn't look quite like the Australian solvency regime, and just reflecting on some of those differences. I think it's safe to say that the aim of the solvency target is quite different. So largely in Australia, the aim is to meet liabilities as they fall due. Whereas in Solvency II, the definition is very much how much capital do you actually need to transfer the liabilities to another willing party. And that transfer would be at a fair value, essentially. Now, the transfer of those liabilities, in terms of concepts, allows for things like PRE and reasonable actions that the people that buy that business might actually want to take out. So in that sense, largely similar to most of the principles of the CAPAD regime. This is all done at a 1 in 200 year probability of ruin. Now, on the surface, that looks weaker than CAPAD regime. I think it's probably safe to say in practice that's pretty dependent on the class of business you have and the extent of discretion and allowance for management actions and so on that you actually take there. I think it's probably too early to say what the calibration of this will actually look like in the end as to just how strong any standard formula may actually be. Now, the key thing here is the use of internal models, and that's really what I'm most interested in and what a lot of the interest is in here. It's a key component of Solvency II. Why is that? Well, simply because you have such a large market in Europe. The nature of risks, the way those risks interact, and the sheer volume and number of products on offer mean that this single set of rules will certainly never be a particularly accurate representation of solvency or capital requirements at that 99.5th percentile level. So the regulators made it very clear that the intention is to really align risk of individual companies with their capital requirements, and therefore internal models are being embraced. They're essentially being sought after. Again, there's another real similarity here with the current Australian framework, but particularly for the GI or non-life market, where APRA has gone down the route of starting to approve internal models. And they've done that ahead of Solvency II, and I suspect what we'll see as they go through that process of reviewing and identifying issues with internal GI models, just how many challenges that actually poses for these regulators. I think within Europe, we're going to see a bit of a free-for-all, I would imagine, if there's going to be a lot of internal models put forward to regulators at the outset, or certainly within the first few years of the solvency regime being put in place. One of the key things that they are looking to try and grasp and capture is this diversification between risks and within risks. And again, this very simple standard formula framework just simply can't allow for that. So when you start to think about tail correlations of risks, non-linear dependencies between risks, and so on, obviously integrating some of these capital charges with simple correlation formulas just doesn't really cut the mustard there. And again, that's where you would certainly expect to see firms coming up with internal models, which I think from a sceptic's point of view, they would certainly be looking to maximise those diversification benefits. And certainly most of the representations made so far in the quantitative impact studies have been that the diversification levels calibrated so far have essentially just been too low for firms with large diversified geographic businesses. So in terms of those internal models, one of the key distinctions that is made here is between full and partial models. Essentially, regulators can, under the Solvency II framework, allow partial models to be used for specific aspects of business, so specific product lines or specific risks in terms of capital allowances. I suspect it's probably unlikely that local regulators will actually want to allow that. I think the level of comfort that they're going to have that firms aren't just cherry-picking specific elements of capital requirements for their own benefit is probably going to be just too much for them to gain sufficient comfort that partial models of risk are actually going to be of particular value. And so I guess perhaps with the exclusion of operational risk-type models, which we've certainly seen from the banking world, are very difficult to integrate within a wider model. I would imagine that most internal models we'll be looking at will be full, large-scale, stochastic models of the entire business. And obviously that poses some huge challenges, which we'll come back to again. In terms of those models, they're going to have to pass a number of tests. So there's a use test, which is essentially the ERM test that firms are actually integrating the model into their business. Statistical quality tests, that covers things like data inputs, statistical standards, actuarial standards, allowances for management actions, decision rules when it comes to actually putting a market-consistent liability valuation on some of those liabilities. I guess the most exacting part of that particular test is going to be the data test. Again, just going back to Basel II, one of the key experiences that most banks found when they were implementing Basel II is that they spent the vast majority of the resources on IT build, on ensuring that data quality and data integrity was actually sufficient to satisfy regulators, that their internal models were better than standard formula and so on and so forth. I think it's certainly safe to say that at the moment, the sort of large-scale internal models that have been developed globally, and there have been quite a few of them developed and in operation across entire organisations, probably don't meet these sorts of standards. So it's probably likely that firms are going to have to invest significant sums if they want to go down the route of using internal models to actually set some of the regulatory capital. Calibration standards, one of the interesting points in there is that firms can actually deviate from the standard capital requirements. So firms can move away from measuring capital on a one-year 99.5% VAR market-consistent asset and liability basis to measuring on some other basis, as long as they can justify that essentially it's consistent. So they can use an alternative time frame, they can use a runoff type projection and on alternative probabilities. In practice, how do firms actually demonstrate that's consistent without actually demonstrating that the number is the same as a one-year 99.5% VAR? I think it's almost inevitable that we won't really see much movement in that space. Documentation standards, there's obviously lots of admin and background and hours and months of work in actuarial departments to comply with these sorts of things. Bottom line, as far as I see it, is that if insurance groups want to go down the route of using insurance models, they're going to need large-scale stochastic asset liability models to go about valuing their liabilities and determining their capital requirements. So in terms of, just back to the original point of asset liability management and asset liability modelling, what are the implications on Solvency II? Again, it's probably just worth reflecting back here on what we've actually seen across the global insurance space as far as development of group-wide economic capital models of firms. Essentially, so far, that's been restricted to the largest global insurers. So in terms of actually going out there and building a horrible, complex, stochastic asset liability model of the entire group business, putting it all together, turn our handle and coming out with an answer, I think there's relatively few firms who are actually at that stage. And that's really just a reflection on just the development cost that's actually going to be in there. Given that there's certainly an expectation that Solvency II is going to be calibrated relatively conservatively, one has to imagine that the capital requirements and benefits from this would dwarf that sort of cost. But obviously there's a usability test and a proportionality test in there, which insurers are going to have to wrestle with as these rules come into force. Certainly that capital saving has been the driver behind most of the developments of internal models, certainly in the last 5 years or so in some of those large insurance groups. I think most of that capital has been savings from the point of view of rating agencies, I guess, the capital markets rather than necessarily regulatory capital, but we'll certainly see more of that as we move forward. The tough part about all of this is that there's a need for market-consistent valuation of all liabilities. Now, that has been where insurance groups have spent all the time developing models and working on these. It's also been the largest technical challenge, I guess, for most of the insurance groups that have gone down this route. Now, typically that approach has been to develop rather complex stochastic liability valuation models. So using risk-neutral modelling techniques, fairly large-scale Monte Carlo models of entire businesses, which allow for path dependencies, policyholder actions, management actions, and various other dynamic assumptions. What does that typically involve? Well, it typically involves calibrating some sort of economic model to market-quoted data, so the price of options, so on and so forth. And that involves huge difficulties in terms of calibration. So how do you actually go about extrapolating 20-year equity implied option vols to go and price the rather nasty variable annuity contract that you've actually priced when you can only go out into the market and buy reasonably liquid options out to perhaps 5 years? So there's obviously lots of scope for actuarial judgment in there, model choices. There's a huge documentation burden in there as well. One of the issues we've certainly seen around the globe is a lack of technical skills in some of these areas. And again, I think this is one of the reasons why this is such a big opportunity for Australian actuaries, is that clearly the quantitative skills and the technical skills do exist to a large extent within Australia already to do this sort of modelling. Again, we'll come back to that when we talk about some of the issues going forward. I touched on data quality and data management. This is going to be a serious issue for firms looking to implement Solvency II. We've had the likes of the FSA in the UK who have had an internal model-based regulatory review system, essentially that Pillar 2 system, in operation for a number of years now. And they've come out and said that in their current format, none of those ICA models would actually meet Solvency II requirements, which I think is a rather ominous-looking statement for most European insurers looking to implement Solvency II. And that is largely around those data and documentation type issues. It's going to take an awful lot of effort to embed some of these models into business. So certainly at the moment there's a significant amount of modelling effort has actually gone on. I would certainly argue that it's limited just how integrated that modelling is into the management of businesses so far. So are those large-scale stochastic asset liability models which are being used to calculate capital requirements in global insurers actually physically being used in the pricing of product? Are they being used in the management of capital? Are they being used in the day-to-day running of the business? Yes, to a certain extent. But I suspect an awful lot more is going to have to be done to satisfy that use test for insurers. The other big challenge there is that, as we've seen over the last few years, there's a huge amount of increasingly complex derivative assets, dynamic strategies, hedging programs, and so on out there. Now, this is only going to increase further as we see things like variable annuities taken off in the likes of Europe and obviously here. Those require some rather tough modelling in many instances. I'm not going to go into the details of that here. There's certainly been some useful sessions on that already, and again, coming up over the next day. But essentially, these large-scale models are going to have to deal with that. So as well as being models which actually have to project assets and liabilities and derive some sort of risk-based capital amount, they're going to have to price some of these complex derivative strategies and hedging programs. The impact of some of those dynamism, the dynamic strategies, management actions and so on, has raised a huge number of issues when it comes to the use of some of these internal models. Again, just drawing on some of the experiences from the UK and the ICA regime there, quite often one of the things that's been seen there are that a number of management actions have been modelled which actually involve some relatively significant get-out clauses. So, you know, the ability to override that management action in some certain set of circumstances, whether that be board approval and so on. And again, the issue of whether or not you can reliably allow for that sort of action in terms of your capital modelling and your capital requirements always comes to the fore. One of the interesting things from various surveys that we've seen in the UK has been the question of just how mutually actionable various actions actually are when it comes to the crunch. So, for instance, we've seen in the recent credit crisis that a complete drying up of liquidity in the credit markets, or an almost complete drying up of liquidity. Various assumptions about what firms might actually do in various situations. For instance, when credit spreads rise by 200 basis points or whatever that situation might actually be. The question is, can firms actually action things without unduly impacting on market prices and so on in there? So that's been a large issue when it comes to essentially verifying the use of some of these models, and that will be an issue going forward for firms involved. Some of the techniques that have actually been implemented are incredibly complex, I think, by their very nature, and much more so than would generally have been used in the past. Now, I'm not entirely sure this is a good thing. I think there's a very, very sensible school of thought that says keep things as simple as you possibly can. But part of the issue within Europe is that there's certainly a recognition that some of the guarantees and options which have been embedded in insurance contracts just simply haven't been recognised in the past. Now, partly that's because there's a large amount of discretion, and a lot of those embedded options and guarantees under previous regimes just haven't been recognised as embedded options and guarantees, policyholder options and so on. Now, that's resulted in much more complex models, but if you think about what an internal capital model is actually going to do, it's essentially got to do two things. One, it's got to value some liabilities at a single point in time, and then it's got to project those liabilities forward in the future across some sort of real-world set of scenarios. Now, the great difficulty that internal models will have in that sort of environment is that you essentially need to use stochastic methods to do both of those things. So if you're going to carry out a market-consistent liability valuation of some complex path-dependent option or guarantee, you're going to want to use some sort of Monte Carlo simulation to actually do that. If you then want to project forward a distribution of how that liability might actually move over time to calculate what your capital requirement will be in a year's time at the 99.5th percentile of that distribution, you're going to have to use some sort of real-world stochastic projection to actually do that going forward. This is one of the issues that's being wrestled with at the moment, certainly across Europe, is that potentially introduces elements of nested stochastic simulation. So in the very simple little example I've got up there, at a number of different points in time, you might project a number of real-world scenarios. At each of those nodes, each of those points in time, you're going to have to do one of those stochastic liability valuations. Now that, with current computing power, where you might be talking about doing tens of thousands of simulations just to value a liability and then tens of thousands of simulations to project that liability over time, is actually just not computationally reasonable. It's just not going to happen at the moment with current computing power. So there's lots of techniques being developed to address this situation, a lot of which draw from a quantitative approach in literature. So using things like valuation techniques that would be used for embedded options within derivatives, least squared Monte Carlo type techniques. There's lots of issues there in terms of recalibrating models on the fly as you have forward projections going on over time. You need to dynamically recalibrate stochastic market consistent, risk neutral type models and so on. So these are all issues which are having to be addressed when it comes to actually implementing some of these sorts of models. Okay, well, I have a number of studies, and what I will do is completely ignore them and say, refer back to the paper if you want to have a look at them. Because what I really want to do here is just have a discussion and just find out what people think Solvency 2 actually means for them. I'll certainly throw in my tuppence worth, which is on the surface for Australian actuaries probably not a lot. Judging by the show of hands, you all disagree with me, which is good. I think the Solvency II regime borrows so heavily from the current Australian CAPAD regime, essentially, that the allowance for most of the discretion, management actions, and so on should already be allowed for. And certainly there's been some interesting papers of note recently, the likes of the paper on optionality and asymmetric risks, which was recently issued by one of the task forces, which off the top of my head I can't remember, but it raises a lot of these issues and emphasises that they're already there and active in Australia, so should already be dealt with. I think in practice there's probably a fair bit more going on and certainly more likely to affect, not least of which there are a number of regimes which are very clearly going to follow Solvency II, so particularly a lot of the Asian regimes which will be struggling to adapt principles of IFRS as well as adopting Solvency II style capital requirement regimes. I think Australian actuaries are particularly well placed to address that. They're already using many of the techniques and allowances that Solvency II will need to make. So I think there's massive scope there for Australian actuarial input and driving towards these elements. I think more generally there is a demand for best practice in asset liability management. An awful lot of that is driven by essentially a filtering down effect. You've got the large insurance groups consider these things best practice in terms of building large scale internal full stochastic asset models and liability models. And I think that will only propagate the global demand, if you like, for some of these techniques. And you certainly do have a trend towards more complex options and guarantees. Judging by the number of papers over this couple of days on capital guaranteed style products and variable annuities and so on, I think it's safe to say that there's undoubtedly going to be an increasing trend towards more complex modelling, just simply to value some liabilities, but also taking that to the next step, projecting capital requirements and certainly capital management of some of those businesses. So I think, yeah, certainly there's a fair bit more in there which Australian actuaries will certainly have to wrestle with, not least of which there are certainly a number of European-based firms who are parents of Australian firms, and certainly be interested to hear some of your thoughts on how the introduction of Solvency II style techniques has actually been impacting your business from a push down from those European parents. And on that beautiful note, Greg, let's open up to some questions and a bit of discussion. I'd certainly like to hear your thoughts on how you think Solvency II is going to impact you and your business.
Okay, questions? You going to kick off? There's one up the back. Where you go, Jason. Just remember to say your name in the microphone if you could.
Jason Slade. You talked a bit about Solvency II and the sort of measurement. Is there any lessons coming out of Europe as what Solvency II is doing for better risk management in insurance companies?
Given that Solvency II hasn't actually been implemented yet, I guess directly no. One of the interesting examples that I touched on earlier actually was this example of the German insurer who uncovered a substantial risk on their books that they just weren't simply aware of because of the current regulatory regime. Now, one of the policies they subsequently put in place was as they were doing this, they were implementing a large-scale stochastic asset liability capital model. And essentially on the back of that, they ended up implementing a derivative trade, which I believe was the largest ever swaption trade, I think at the time, probably still is. The notional on this thing was billions and billions of dollars. And that was an action which was taken just as a very direct response to implementing Solvency II style capital requirements, essentially, and an internal model. I hate to think that there's lots more of those in the pipeline. I'm sure lots of our investment banking colleagues will love to think that there's lots more of those in the pipeline. But, you know, I think that's just one example where firms have started to implement actions as a direct result of implementing some of these models. In the UK, there's been very similar issues, but I think many of the actions there have been implementing dynamic hedging style programmes to directly address some of the risks which are actually on the books there. There's been various talks today and tomorrow on use of some sort of fairly non-standard types of capital market instruments, various securitisations and so on. I think, again, on the back of some of that capital work, there has been a trend towards trying to do things like securitise mortality and longevity risk. But that's just met with an awful lot of obstacles. And I think there's only really been one or two examples of successful trades very recently where the capital markets and the insurers have managed to finally agree a price for some of those risks. But those are examples, or good examples, which I think have arisen largely because of these sorts of regimes.
Andrew, did you have a question? Anybody's got their form while Andrew's coming to the thing? We should put on there, make sure you have roving mics for the next one. I'm not quite sure we didn't have them for this one, but anyway.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to address your question as to how it was actually affecting actuarial departments. And obviously, around the world, I do practically all my work outside Australia. And I'm responsible for a relatively small insurance companies, fast growing, in parts of the world that don't have developed asset markets. And there aren't very many actuaries. And this Solvency II, and we work in an international group, it's a German group, and this is a severe risk to all these businesses, and it's fundamentally a risk of distraction. And if I take the Malaysian actuarial department, there are only two qualified actuaries. I'm one of them. And we have the proposition of doing enormous exercises to work out the costs of options and guarantees. Now, the practical running of the Malaysian business is to avoid guarantees. I mean, just don't do it. And this is actually a serious worry. Now, we have the proposition that somebody at some stage will send us an economic scenario generator. Now, we know that any economic scenario generator for Malaysia is going to be a nonsense. And our bosses are going to pay more money than they pay for our actuarial department to pay, I don't know whether there's anybody here, to pay Barry and Hibbert to give us some spreadsheets to develop these numbers. And we will feed the monster, which is our group actuarial requirement. Now, it may be that this is rational because at the centre, the rationality, the market requires our group to be able to say that it has a worldwide actuarial model. But the practical risk management issues for us are to do with the terms of business. You can survive a lot of things in insurance companies. You can survive getting the valuation wrong. You can certainly survive getting the EV and the MCEV and all the rest of it wrong. What you can't survive is writing business at too cheap a premium rate and for terms that are just unviable. So you say opportunities for Australian actuaries. The real opportunity out there, and for any of the Australian consultants who tour through the region, is a way of actually providing an approach which fits for small actuarial departments in countries which don't have developed asset markets to actually show willing, because it's not a terribly good idea to take on head office full on and say, we're not actually going to do it. and actually provide it in a way that can show some sort of movement. And I'm sure doing stochastic scenario generations can be useful in certain circumstances, but it is, I have to say, extremely worrying. One of the difficulties related to the cultural adjustments is actually being able to signal what's a joke and what isn't. And in talking to my German colleagues, referring to the fact that now we're going to have 10,000 scenarios for our calculations, I observed that we were now going to have 10,000 times 10,000 analysis of change, thinking that this might actually be a mild cause for amusement. I don't actually think it is. I think there may, in fact, actually be a scenario of stochastic management, which is maybe may work for big organisations, but for small organisations, how to manage this is a severe problem for actuaries out in the field.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. I think one of the points I touched on earlier was that proportionality is one of the key considerations here. I think it's a huge challenge to deal with the parent organisation in that instance, and clearly the politics and what's coming down from a central risk function is probably going to be the largest single issue there. The Solvency II regime itself, in practice, they have put quite a strong focus on proportionality there. So they have put a very strong focus on saying firms that want to can adopt more complex methods to do various bits and pieces, and there are simplifications and standard formula to be used in other circumstances, and that should be entirely proportionate, and I think that's right. I wish I could help you with your political considerations within the organisation, but I think that's perhaps a different issue altogether. As far as extrapolating market movements and so on in some of these regimes, yes, that is always a huge challenge. So trying to infer valuations from incomplete markets it's a subjective issue which you will not find the right answer to wherever you go. And thankfully, that's why we have actuaries to fill the gap and use judgment and subjectivity where it's appropriate and needs to be done. And certainly the implementation of large-scale models isn't going to change that, and certainly won't change the need for that level of proportionality and judgment, which you're spot on in raising. Yeah. Thank you.
Another question? Come on. I did have one thought for you, Andrew. If you're only 0.005% of the total German monolith, then maybe you could suggest out of 10,000 simulations, you could do 5. A good one, a bad one, and a middle one, and something or other else.
The tragedy of doing that 5 is that the parent will probably say, well, in actual fact, the standard error around some of your estimates there is larger than an entire group. You probably need to argue the case on that one.
We're getting distracted.
Everybody knows what the German is for materiality.
Any other questions? Does anybody have anything on the rest of the paper or any comments? One of the things I actually thought was quite useful when I looked at the paper was some of those graphs that looking at sort of explaining materiality of what was important and wasn't and contributing to variance and risks and all the rest of it, I actually found quite useful. So,
If there was any room to expand on the diversification point.
Your diversification point, which...
In terms of the extent to which insurance groups are seeking diversification benefits across the group.
They're all running limited liability subsidiaries around the place, and the regulator is quite justified in saying, it's limited liability. It's not there for diversification.
I mean, the key thing about these sorts of models for these guys is, and this is the big, I guess, element of supervisory review that needs to be done here, is just how much credit can they actually get for capital fungibility. So the ability to move capital around different operating entities and between the groups. My guess is that a lot of the representations that have been made so far that capital requirements in general are just too strenuous. A lot of the benefits that are being claimed here are benefits assuming that all the capital has been held at a group level and will be freely distributed as and when it's needed across the group. Now, I suspect those are assumptions which will need some very thorough review by regulators. Yes, I'm not sure the guaranteed part is what's been modelled here. I mean, the reasonable outcome will be that capital would be provided in a lot of instances, and where that's justified, then that can be modelled. But yeah, the assumptions and made when doing that are going to be under pretty close scrutiny, I would imagine.
Okay, do we have any last question? Isabel did go. Okay, well, if that's it. I was a little remiss because I couldn't find it in my little pack when I sat down. I didn't actually introduce Craig properly before. That's Craig McCulloch, everybody. McCulloch. Works for KPMG. Has previously worked for Standard Life and worked for, Barry and Hibbert.
Sorry.
obviously, he's a guru and all this stuff. So, at the coffee break, if you've got any other questions, Craig would love to answer those. But for the now, if you'd like to join with me and just thank Craig for his paper and his presentation.